right, Mr. Gill, you may proceed. I'm sorry, for our recording, I would like our clerk to announce the case.
Court, we now call John Turner, developer of the state of Texas, and may please report that the law is here to all the federal appellate, and the state attorney to all the federal state.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, and good morning. Last few days, I've been looking forward to my first ever argument in the Court of Appeals, and on my way down here this morning, I realized I'm still not going to get my first argument in the Court of Appeals, but I do get to make an argument to the Court of Appeals, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning. The last case you heard seemed like it was very law intensive, and I think in this particular case, at least as to point number one, the law is pretty well settled. I cited and relied on the Wilkerson case in my brief, and so did the appellee. I think what distinguishes the St. Angelo case under consideration today from other cases of Wilkerson and other cases that have cited Wilkerson are the facts. And I want to make three main points with regard to the facts this morning. Number one, the context of the questioning in the St. Angelo case is very different from the context of the questioning in the other cases that are cited in these briefs. The purpose of the questioning is very different, and also the character or the goal of the questions in this case is very different from the other reported cases. Starting with the context of the questioning, perhaps the biggest differentiating factor here between this case and other cases is while Mr. St. Angelo was being questioned by the paramedic, Mr. Evans in this case, leading to our assertion that he was an agent of the state of Texas, the police officer was present and there and taking notes while Evans was questioning the appellant. In other cases, the Elizondo case, the Haley case, other cases that are cited under Wilkerson, the police department was nowhere near the questioning as it was taking place. Elizondo, there was a loss prevention officer talking to the appellant in that case, the defendant in that case. The police officers were nowhere around. In Haley, a CPS officer was talking to the defendant appellant. Police officers were nowhere around. In this case, a law enforcement officer was present in the van, in the ambulance, with appellant and Mr. Evans, and was taking notes and able to at least visually interact with appellant and Mr. Evans while this was going on. It's a completely different fact situation than we've seen in the other cases. The purpose of the questioning. You see in the Elizondo case, the Haley case, the Wilkerson case, the phrase separate but parallel is used. There were separate but parallel investigations going on. The police department was doing an investigation into the criminal conduct, and the civilians were doing an investigation into some type of conduct that they were interested in. In the Elizondo case, it was a shoplifting case. The police departments were interested in the theft aspect of it. The loss prevention officer was interested in the loss prevention. He was representing the store in that situation. They were investigating the same conduct. They were investigating the same thing. They had the same goal to try to prevent and deter that person and others from committing thefts. In the Haley case, CPS was investigating and determining the welfare of the child, which was a parallel investigation to what was going on with the police department. In this case, there were separate, and I submit, perpendicular investigations going on. Evans's job was to try to treat appellant for his injuries and to try to ascertain how he might best be treated when he arrived at the hospital. The police department was investigating criminal conduct. But during the course of Evans's questioning of appellant, he crossed over, very clearly crossed over, from his medical intervention and his medical treatment to being an agent of the state of Texas and the prosecution when he asked questions such as, were you firing at police officers? Good question.
Go ahead.
Looking at the factors of the Wilkerson case, one of the main factors is, were the questions aimed at gaining information and evidence for a criminal prosecution, or were they related to some other goal? The question, were you shooting at police officers, has nothing to do with medical treatment. It has absolutely nothing to do with medical treatment, and it has everything to do with building evidence for later prosecution of Mr. Santangelo.
Okay, in reading the record of the hearing, and particularly the paramedics, Mr. Evans' testimony, his testimony was unequivocal that he was not directed by the police to ask any questions, that all the questions that he asked were the purpose was for medical treatment. I mean, he shot himself as well as shooting, allegedly, at police officers. He explained all of his reasons, none of which fall into the categories that you want to put them in. So basically, wasn't that just a credibility call of the fact finder in deciding that that was admissible testimony? Because there's no testimony in that record that stands for that he was operating under the direction of the police officer, or that they had perpendicular purposes, or at least I couldn't find it. Perhaps you can direct me to it.
One thing I can direct you to is one of the factors under the Wilkerson case, which is, did the police give the interviewer either explicit instructions or implicit instructions? At the hearing, Evans was asked about explicit instructions. He was not asked, and the court did not make any specific findings, were there any implicit instructions. And that gets back to the police officer being right there in front of Mr. Evans, taking notes as he was going through his questioning of appellant.
But wouldn't it be equally arguable that by testifying that all the questions that I asked were directed toward my purposes as a medical professional, wouldn't that be some evidence that it wasn't based upon an implicit belief that he needed to be helping the police officers?
One of the things that I noticed going through that record was that when Evans testified, he was confronted with certain points that were made, certain questions that he asked, and then later on at trial, he did not testify to the jury at trial. An officer, Brenda Salazar from the Fort Worth Police Department, the officer that was present when appellant was questioned and gave his answers, testified to the jury. And one of the things she testified, the blunt question, were you shooting at police officers? That has nothing to do with medical intervention or treatment. That had everything to do with finding out information that the police department did not have, and they were only able to gather through one source, that being appellant. A couple of those questions had to do with his intent, not with the objective facts of the case, where the bullets landed or anything like that, but his intent at the time that he was engaged in this conduct. In one fell swoop, one answer, he could have been charged not with disorderly conduct, firing a weapon in city property, in city boundaries, but with a first-degree felony, aggravated assault on a peace officer, based upon his one-word answer to one question.
That's not what this appeal is about. This appeal is about the murder case. And wasn't there circumstantial evidence that he was firing at police officers?
There was circumstantial evidence, but there was no direct evidence. And the whole facts of this case were that he was charged with murdering his wife. The shooting of the police officers was a punishment issue. But the shooting of his wife, he testified at trial, was done in self-defense. So again,
Didn't he stab his wife?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Just wanna...
He did stab his wife. Okay. And he testified at trial that he stabbed his wife. The question, again, was not the objective facts of him doing that. The question at trial was his motivation. He testified he was acting in self-defense. The questions that were asked by paramedic Evans had to do with his motivation and his state of mind at the time these things were going on, something that the police could find out no other way than through him. And I can also note from the record, and this took some digging into the record, but one of the points that the appellee made in their brief was that the state of Texas already had their case made against appellant, and no, they didn't. They still needed to know what his intent was at the time of the offense.
So rather than the focus on his intent at shooting at the police officers, there was also a question in the ambulance or wherever he was regarding why he stabbed his wife. I recall reading that police officer testified that he said something about she was running her mouth, or he got tired of her mouth, or something like that.
Yes.
And so are you saying, I haven't read the entire record yet, but have you? Are you saying that there's nothing else in the record that is the only, that's the only evidence you have in the record, the state had in the record, of his intent with regard to the murder?
It's direct evidence of his intent. That's why these statements are so damaging, because he testified to one thing at trial during the defendant's portion of the case, and these were admitted by the state of Texas, which directly contravene his statements at trial, and thus call into issue his credibility as a witness.
Didn't he also tell his daughter that he stabbed her in great detail and slashed her throat? Didn't he tell his daughter that,
yes,
too?
Yes, he did. Yes, he
okay,
did.
Okay, so that's direct. That's just like, how's that any different than telling the paramedic?
Again, that's what he did. The question is, when he's testifying that he acted in self-defense, the question is why he did it. There's no question he fired, and he admitted firing a firearm. The question was, did he fire at police officers? That was the evidence of that conduct, of that motivation, came through this questioning by paramedic Evans in the presence of the police officer. So that's why these statements are so damaging.
I have a question about the Wilkerson case. Looking at the factors, I was unclear from your brief as well as the state's brief, if when we're looking at the factors, the interviewer's actions and perceptions factor and the defendant's perceptions of the encounter factor, are those objective? Is that an objective standard of review for this court, or is it subjective? Is the subjective statement of paramedic Evans that he wasn't acting for police, is that, and the defendants didn't testify at the suppression hearing, but in other words, you understand my question. Do we review that under a subjective standard or an objective standard, and what's the case law to support that?
I don't think there is any case law to support that one way or the other. Wilkerson to me is kind of a standalone case. There's a lot of cases that rely on Wilkerson, but this is the most complete explication we have of the factors to be looked at in determining whether or not someone was an agent of the state of Texas. But ultimately, I think this court needs to look objectively at, was there an implicit agreement between the agent, Evans, and the Fort Worth Police Department? No, in response to an earlier question, no, the police department did not hand him a plastic badge and say, go ask some questions. But he knew from being around that investigation for a period of time, the radio traffic, his involvement in being a part of that interdisciplinary team of police department and ambulance attendants and EMTs, he knew what the issues were. And the issues were going to be, what was Mr. San Angelo thinking at the time all these things went on? And the police still didn't have good answers to that. And I don't think they realized they had this information at the time. Later on, a few days after Mr. San Angelo got out of the hospital, after spending a period of time in the hospital, he had been appointed counsel on January 7th and appointed counsel after a request on January 6th. And a few days while he was in JPS Hospital under guard, and a few days after he got down to the Tarrant County Jail, the Fort Worth Police Department, without regard to the Sixth Amendment, went over and tried to question him some more at the Tarrant County Jail. They still wanted answers to some of the questions they had about his motivation until they realized they had this information. I'm sorry?
Is that in the record?
It is in the record.
Okay.
It's in the clerk's record. Page 14 was the appointment of counsel, and then there was a Brady motion filed by the state of Texas that's contained in the clerk's record that shows that the Fort Worth Police Department admitted going over and contacting him a few days after he reached the Tarrant County Jail, which was after he was in the hospital, still being treated for his injuries at the time he was appointed counsel. So he had counsel at the time Fort Worth Police Department went back to question him some more. And just a word about point two, the state, am I done? Okay, two more seconds, don't I? The state said he didn't, trial counsel did not preserve error on my point number two, which was the
Limitation on voir dire?
Yeah, the limitation on voir dire. I think it was very clear that when counsel made her record about what she wished to question about, she was not allowed to question anymore. That obviously, court overruled her request at that point, and she pretty clearly stated the subject matter she wanted to cover with the court, and it wasn't any secret. Those are matters that are very often covered in criminal cases and very important to a criminal case. The state makes the point in their appellee's brief that the court charged the jury on these very issues, but the counsel needs to know if the jury could follow the charge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Mr. Condor?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Stephen Condor for the state of Texas. The facts in this case are actually relatively straightforward, that on December 30th of 2013, the appellant, frustrated at the collapse of his marriage, went to his wife's place of work, stabbed her to death, then fled the scene where he was held up in a nearby house until a police standoff until he surrendered, during which he shot himself. That pretty much, those basic facts are not in dispute in this case. And that's kind of the underlying this case, is that the actual stabbing, death, murder of his wife is, it's pretty clear cut, and it's pretty clear cut for a jury to decide upon his guilt of that offense. Now, the issues that come about in the subsequent of his, after his, he's taken away to the hospital. And that's where I'm gonna focus most of my argument on, is that the trial court conducted a full-blown suppression hearing on whether or not the statements that were made in the ambulance in the presence of Officer Salazar were admissible. The trial court heard from all the witnesses. They were subject to direct examination. They were subject to cross-examination. And at the end of it, he made the determination that there was no, based upon his view, listening to these officers and making credibility determinations, there was no agency relationship between the police and paramedic Evans, and that it was, and that as such, the statements that were made when he was being questioned by the paramedic about his medical issues were not a product of custodial interrogation. Now, yes, paramedic Evans is a government employee. He's employed by EMT, and he was brought to the scene of a police incident. But the fact that a government employee alone is not to make them an agent of the state. And I think the case law is pretty clear. And as Mr. Gill pointed out, there's really not in this case the basic structure of law of determining what is an agent of the state, who is an agent of the state, and who isn't in the Wilkerson case. I think that's pretty decided. So we're not really looking at what is the broad law, but how does it apply to this case. And so they did give us three things to look at. And to answer Judge Walker's question about the, I think that Mr. Gill was correct. There is no case law that says that this is an objective standard or a subjective standard. Now, I do think that if you look at the laundry list of questions that were brought up in the Wilkerson case, particularly involving like the interviewer's actions and perceptions, I think by nature there has to be a certain subjective element to it, because you're asking what were his reasons? Why was he doing something? Why did he come up with these questions? What was he trying to accomplish? I think all of that is inherently subjective. On the flip side, I think if the defendant had testified at the suppression hearing, then his statements would also be viewed under a subjective standard. However, since he did not, I believe it was in the Elizondo case that the Court of Criminal Appeals said that then they must consider whether a reasonable person would believe that the interviewer was law enforcement. I think at that point then we start to shift into more of an objective standard. So, but turning back to the first factor, yes, certain, I think you can go down the laundry list and you can find some things that might have gotten the trial court to say maybe there was a possible agency relationship. Other factors that said maybe there wasn't a possible agency relationship. I think the critical one is, was there any kind of an agreement with the paramedic to obtain certain evidence, and did they provide questions or participate in these questionings? And I think both Mr. Evans and Officer Salazar, they were very clear-cut at the trial court that they did not. That Officer Evans did not provide any questions, she did not direct in it, she did not participate in any way, that she was sitting there in the in the ambulance because they were transporting a murder suspect to the hospital. I mean, and there's nothing from the record to suggest that they, that the police, everybody got together and they were going to, paramedic Evans, we want you to get this information from this particular defendant. The record, there's nothing from it. And so I think that we have to take, because the judge, the trial court judge made a credibility finding that they were credible and that their statements regarding their actions and their intent go with the fact that there was no agency relationship. I think we have to take that at face value now. And with, and as such, there's no evidence of a calculated practice. Now, I will admit, Mr. Gill is correct. There is a significant, there's a difference between our case and the Elizondo and Haley case. And in those cases, law enforcement was not present. And I think, you know, that was a factor that the trial court could consider in the agency relationship. But I think that more significant is the fact that there was really no direct involvement of any kind between Officer Salazar and the defendant while they were in the ambulance. And I think that is actually more critical in determining whether or not an agency relationship exists. Plus, I would further point out that in the Elizondo case, the court noted that the loss prevention officer was not acting as a police agent, even if his question obtained information that went beyond just mere civil damage and civil recovery. So there isn't anything in the case law which says it has to be, you know, that the only questions they ask is so limited that it can't be used for anything beyond what their primary duty is. So I think if you look at the whole case in particular, I think that the judge did not abuse his discretion in finding there was no agency relationship between paramedic Evans and the Fourth Police, and particularly Officer Salazar.
I believe in your brief, and I can't find it right now, but didn't you agree that one of the questions was not related to medical treatment? Like, where is your wife, or something like that? Maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe that was pointed out in the appellant's brief.
I don't recall making that particular statement in my brief, and if I did, but I don't think it's... You know, yes, I will. It doesn't go directly to, you know, to the particular injuries he has between the injury he's received shooting himself or the injury he received when they took him down in the front yard of the house. But I think it does still go to, like, he's asking about this, all the events. He's asking about these events because he's trying to figure out what is the defendant's mental status? What does he understand about what he has done?
I guess what I'm asking is there a line? I mean, is there a line that occurs when someone who isn't an explicit agent or starts out not even being an implicit agent, a police officer, starts questioning in front of police who are taking notes? Isn't there a line where the police need to stop and say, hey, let's give some Miranda warnings? Is that correct? Or is there no line? And as long as you don't start out being an agent of law enforcement, you're never an agent of law enforcement.
No, I think there would be a line. And if he had gone into, like, you know, why did you go, you know, started asking, why did you go to that thing? Why were you stabbing? Why specifically did you stab your wife? Did you go into specific facts? I think, yes, it can cross the line. Do I think that his general question, you know, what about your wife? I don't think that's there yet, but I think yes. I think in all cases, I think you could look at the... There could be a line where all of a sudden you're looking at it and they have gone far afield of where they need to be. I don't think this is the case here, but I agree with you. I think that it's not once, you know, it's not free range questioning by the paramedic. And I think it also, as the court pointed out, and I'll just touch it briefly, is with the, is it even if you were to say that paramedic Evans crossed the line and his statements would be on that none of the information that he brought up really was new information that could not be acquired from somewhere else. The questions about, you know, what happened with his wife, there were other witnesses to that. The statements he made to his daughter go to his intent of, like, with the stabbing and the fact that he fought her. The statement he made at the hospital that was spontaneous. The facts of the standoff. A lot of that was very, you know, was brought in through with other witnesses. So there was, even if Mr. Evans crossed the line, which I'm not conceding in any way, it still was nothing. It was nothing unique. It was not some unique statement that.
Are you saying that everything that was reported that he said in the ambulance is merely cumulative? Every single piece?
No, I don't think I could. I don't think I could say that without having going back in the record and looking at every single thing. But I think that the substance of what he was asked, and the substance of the statement that he made there is other evidence.
So there's no unique. Your position is there's no unique information elicited from him that would have caused harm because of its admission.
That is my point.
Okay.
I will just briefly touch on the voir dire point. It's the state's position that the case law is fairly clear that to preserve error in a voir dire limitation, that you have to provide the court with at least through a bill of exception or something, some sort of specific questions that you would have asked of the court. That just simply providing general topics to the court is not going to preserve that error for you. And I think the other parts of that are fairly adequately briefed by both sides and for the court. And so unless the court has any further questions, the state would just pray for an affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Condor. Rebuttal?
Mr. Gill, with regard to the voir dire point, I did not see where the trial court actually gave an adverse ruling when she approached and asked that the record be supplemented with what she would have gone, the subject matter that she would have gone into if the trial court had let her exceed the time constraints. Is there an explicit ruling in the record?
I didn't find one either, Judge. And what I'm relying on there is the fact that she was not allowed to continue with her question. That was the adverse ruling that made. She was sat down and board I was over at that point.
My recollection of the record was that he just simply said, is everybody ready for something else? And they moved on.
Right.
But he never said denied, overruled, or I'm not going to give you more time.
Exactly. Okay. He never used that verbiage. He sat her down and the trial moved on. But going back to an earlier question you had about whether or not this information that was gathered from appellant by paramedic Evans was cumulative. It was not cumulative. There's nowhere else in that record where we see a direct statement attributed to appellant that he was firing at police officers. There's nowhere else in that record where we see a direct statement from appellant where he admitted to, quote, doing something bad like he did to Officer Evans. Both of those things are unique in that record. And both of those were elicited by paramedic Evans.
Why may not have used the words doing something bad? Didn't he admit to Officer Triago or Trigo or something like that at the hospital that he had stabbed and killed his wife?
That he killed her. He admitted that he killed her.
Okay, well.
But again, the issue in this case was not whether or not he killed her. The issue was whether or not he was acting in self-defense at the time he killed her. So there's a
which would have made the difference in whether it's a bad act or not a bad act.
As far as
the law is concerned.
That is correct, Your Honor. Whether or not it was justified. But ultimately, what this court has to decide is whether that, in fact, custodial interview of appellant was explicitly or, as I'm relying on, implicitly conducted on behalf of the police for law enforcement purposes. And there's ample evidence that that was implicitly done by paramedic Evans. And I will note that the trial court, at the time the trial court ruled on the admissibility of these statements, did not have the benefit of seeing ultimately what appellant's testimony and what his defense was going to be. That didn't come until after this testimony was ruled on pretrial and then admitted at trial. So the trial court did not have the benefit of all that information when the trial court made this ruling.
The defendant had the opportunity to testify at the motion to suppress if he so chose.
If he so chose.
So what is the point of that last statement that the court didn't have the benefit of that?
The
Are we
point
supposed
is
to consider that in some way that, I mean, What is the point of that?
The point is his trial testimony is a lot different from what his testimony would have been at the motion to suppress. If the motion to suppress, his testimony would have been limited to his recollections and knowledge of what occurred in that ambulance. And the record shows that he was in there suffering from a gunshot wound. He was being taken advantage of by the questioners at that point.
Do we judge the trial court's decision-making based on what the trial court knew at the time or the record as a whole as it played out in the end?
We have to look at it both ways, at what the trial court knew at the time and then what the trial court ultimately knew and ultimately what the facts of the case were in looking back under the guidelines of the Wilkerson case.
So the suppression issue was re-urged before the evidence was offered at trial?
No, but the testimony was presented before appellant's testimony at trial. This whole thing could have been solved by two simple things. Number one, the Fort Worth Police Department reading appellant his Miranda warnings before he was questioned by their agent in the ambulance. Or number two, the trial court simply parsing out a couple of the questions that were asked of appellant in that ambulance. Were you shooting at the police officers? Did you do something bad? And basically, why did you do this? Would have been very simple to do. But instead, there's evidence that the police department implicitly used paramedic Evans as their agent, and he was their instrumentality or conduit in obtaining information they would not otherwise be able to gather.
But as to the question, why did you do this, there is other evidence in the record, maybe not from his lips, but there's other evidence in the record as to why he did this.
There's the state's theory as to why he did it. The state's theory.
Not just argued, but there's some evidence to support their theory.
There was evidence, because okay. Some people came in and said he killed her and he was angry with her and everything else, but his testimony at trial was he did it in self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he tell his daughter in so many words why he did it?
He told his daughter that he killed her. And that he was...
Okay.
Yeah. He admitted the actions, but he did not go into his motivation in the circumstances surrounding it. There was a lot of evidence about what happened. There was not very much evidence about his motivation. His state of mind.
Did trial counsel ask the court to just, using your words, parse out those three questions, or did the trial counsel just simply ask that testimony not be allowed in its entirety?
I believe there was a blanket objection.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Condor. Your case is submitted, and we will have the clerks adjourn court, and then we will have a Q&A with the students. I believe all of the attorneys have agreed to stay briefly if they are able. I believe Mr. Gill needs to step out and check that he can remain, but you can feel free to ask the